time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Condi. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little sketchy out there this morning. A few cars off the road on the interstate. Kind of depends on where you are, if anybody's been out plowing, or if just with the weather conditions, sort of a bad combination. So be mindful of that as you're out there traveling about, out and about. And you can join us on the program this morning at any time you want. You can join us on the phone at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We're going to delve into the world of mental illness here in just a moment. Later this hour, we're going to connect with Anthony Poor, who's with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. He's going to be at a conference going on up at Burlington, a housing conference, and we'll talk with Anthony about the what he says is the declining number of young home buyers, and we'll find out why that's all happening. Coming up next hour, I'm looking forward to our discussion. We're going to be joined by a local orthodontist and a young woman who goes to Johnson State College who is helped by that orthodontist as part of a community project, a giving back to the community kind of a project. So we'll find out about that coming up in hour number two this morning. And again, love to hear from you at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. We head out to the West Coast. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Joe Guppy. Joe has written about his experiences as a patient in a mental facility, and he's joining us called the Fluorescent God, and he joins us live on the line this morning. Joe, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm quite well. The book is My Fluorescent God.
I'm sorry, My Fluorescent God, as opposed to The Fluorescent God. We don't want to get those confused or anything,
right,
do we?
It's the personal story of My Fluorescent God.
That's right. And it's nobody else's Fluorescent God.
Well, all it right. could be. You can have a Fluorescent God. It's just
it wouldn't be yours,
though. It's kind of a personal thing. It wouldn't be mine.
Exactly. That's right. So let's maybe deal with that right up front here. So who is your Fluorescent God?
Well, the title comes from the kind of the spiritual aspect of this book. I call it a psychological and spiritual journey. And that refers to this one of the narrative arcs in the book, which is about coming to grips with the childhood religious teachings that were quite harsh. I was raised Roman Catholic in kind of a strict Orthodox way, and part of the mental illness experience, as you may know, often involves religious ideas, even religious delusions, as it did in my case. And I had to get through some of those harsher religious teachings to a more benevolent view of who God is, what the divine presence is in my life. And fortunately, I ended up having a positive spiritual experience while in the hospital.
I've never heard anybody make that connection between mental illness or depression and religious thoughts.
Well, it's probably more common in the psychotic realm. People with schizophrenia and such often, well, I guess the classic would be people who say, you know, I'm Jesus Christ, hold a sign down on a street corner or something. That's really far out on the spectrum, but it is relatively common in that world.
Mm-hmm. What happened when you were 23?
Well, I was 23 in 1979, and 78 was a really difficult year for me. I was going through kind of a early 20s quarter life crisis, which I think a lot of young people still go through. I think it's kind of a classic. You graduate from college and you feel a little adrift. There's no real structure around you anymore, but you feel like, well, I've got to make my way in the world and prove myself. There was that. I had broken up with a girlfriend. What we call in psychotherapy life stressors were all kind of impinging upon me. And then I went to Mexico to check out a possibility of a job teaching English there, and I had a travel medication that my doctor had prescribed to me, and completely unbeknownst to me, what I thought were stomach pills turned out to have this side effect called toxic psychosis. And given that I was already very much on the edge, that rocket shipped me into kind of a psychotic, delusional world. And the story of My Fluorescent God is mainly about how I recovered from that really crazy place.
So the pills were the trigger?
Yeah, they were the trigger into actual just hallucinations. I would have a very dramatic experiences, like the whole visual field in front of my face would sort of granulate into melting yellow sand. I had a lot of synesthesia, as we call it, which means the joining of the senses. So sounds take on colors, and colors take on feelings. There's sort of a loss of brain filters that keep the stimuli in kind of in order.
Whoa!
So yeah, it was real freaky there. Shortly after taking those pills.
Wow! I mean, that sounds like you took some sort of psychedelic drug or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very similar to that, very extreme, but a key. So one of the sections in the book is this final section where I do interviews with other therapists, contemporaries of mine, and 30 years later, and we kind of unpack the case. We look at this case study, happens to be me, and one of those is with a Veterans Administration therapist who talks about trauma. And he pointed out that the fact that I didn't know I had been dosed made it much more traumatic than somebody who has a bad trip on LSD or something, but they knew that they took the LSD, whereas
right.
For me, this just came out of nowhere and seemed to fit a story that I was already telling myself that I'm going crazy, even though it did go to a much more extreme place.
So you just took a couple of these pills, or did you take them over a long period of time?
It wasn't a long period of time. I think it only took like three or four, but that's sufficient. If you talk to people about these medications, it actually turns out to be an anti-malarial drug, which I didn't realize. But there's at least one other book about this kind of experience. And if I had a large cocktail party and say, hey, did anybody ever have a weird experience with anti-malarial medication?
Huh.
You'll get a little show of hands.
Really? Wow, that's so interesting. Joe Guppy is the author of My Fluorescent God. And as you heard him mention, too, he's also gone on to become a psychotherapist. All right, so you wind up in Seattle's Providence Hospital in the mental ward.
Mm-hmm.
Was that like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? What are we talking about?
Well, it wasn't quite that hardcore, because that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was sort of like a big state institution. This was a smaller place, a second, it took up the whole second floor of the hospital. There were like 50 beds in two different wards. But it was more gentle than that in some ways, but in other ways they did have sort of a nurse ratchet approach on one of the mental wards, which was kind of the advanced therapy ward, but the therapy that they used was very confrontative, very cognitive behavioral, And it just didn't work for me, because I was, as I said, I was put into this paranoid, delusional state where I actually believed that I had died and was now living in hell, awaiting punishment. And so this kind of in-your-face therapy style fit the storyline that the nurses were demons and that my psychiatrist was Satan.
Jeez. I mean, that sounds like the exact opposite of what you needed.
Yeah, and it's kind of part of my crusade, if you will, in writing the book, is to advocate for the kind of therapy that I think is helpful and the kind of therapy that isn't. And it mainly has to do with the human connection that, you know, the insurance companies would probably like it if there was a manual 6 pages long that treated any mental illness in 6 sessions. That the therapist, maybe the intern, could just go through by the numbers or something. But it doesn't really work that way. It takes a lot of skill and a lot of training to be able to connect on the human person-to-person level to people who are in these disturbed states.
What were you actually diagnosed with, Joe?
Well, initially it was toxic psychosis. Then I also had a diagnosis of psychotic depression with paranoid features. But ultimately, I had two psychiatrists, and the second psychiatrist, who was very, very helpful to me, landed on the idea of what he called panic reaction, which today would be called panic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, part of my message is it's the diagnoses are fine. They're tools. They help people understand. They help people know that they're not alone, like, oh, I have this thing, and other people have a similar thing. So that's all fine, but we have to remember that the human person is much greater than any diagnosis, and certainly one of the worst things about the stigma of mental illness is when people get pigeonholed, you know,
right.
to a diagnosis.
Right. What sort of drugs did they put you on?
Well, the main one that I got right off the bat was called Haldol, which is similar to Thorazine, which is a very powerful antipsychotic, and you know, it has a kind of calming, tranquilizing effect, but at the same time, it had some pretty severe side effects, which fit my storyline of being that I'm going to be tortured. I, at one point, very early on, I had this tremendous neck cramp that twisted my neck, and again, it fit the narrative. So, in that case, it was counterproductive.
Wow. How long did this nightmare go on for you?
Oh, I was in the hospital for 2.5 months, and then I was in a halfway house for 2.5 months. But, you know, it all sounds pretty horrid, obviously, the way we've been talking about it so far, and certainly it was. But at the same time, overall, in my whole life story, I look back and see it as a gift, because it sort of forced me to face up to some real life issues I had, relationships with women, relationships with my dad, relationships with my religion, as I said earlier. And, you know, these are issues that I would have had to deal with in the long run one way or the other. Maybe it wouldn't have happened in such a dramatic fashion, but a lot of My Fluorescent God is about that story of healing, not just from the initial trauma of that taking that medication, but of a healing of real life issues that most people share.
Mm-hmm. So how did you, as you describe it, face up to those issues, including your dad and women?
Well, so there was a psychiatric nurse there was a major character in the book named Patricia, and parenthetically, I did interview her 30 years later, and we talked about the case. That was a very moving experience for me. And then she was at my book reading, my book launch reading and such. So, but with her, I was able to form what we call a therapeutic alliance and, you know, confess, some of my, feelings about having betrayed my ex-girlfriend, that sort of thing, like work through those issues of feeling that I hadn't had the best behavior with regard to my ex-girlfriend. And as far as my dad goes, my second psychiatrist was sort of like a substitute father, which I wasn't aware of at the time, but sort of a classic Freudian idea of what we call transference, which means that the patient projects onto the therapist a sense of other people in his or her life. So in this case, the psychiatrist was able to be sort of a fill-in father figure for me that helped me work through issues in that area. And then plus I made a better connection with my actual dad as well.
Mm-hmm. So how long, at what point did the really sort of intense part of this, you know, where you're seeing things, you're hearing, it sounded as though how long did that go on?
Well, the super intense part probably went on for maybe 4 days to a week, something like that, with the florid hallucinations and the sort of complete loss of reality, almost sort of like a feeling like I was physically in some other reality. By the time I was admitted to the hospital, reality itself had stabled because I was sent home for a weekend. Once they discovered that I'd taken this medication, I was sent home for the weekend at my parents' house, which was, I think, kind of a mistake because I was very suicidal and I really needed to be contained more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gave an opportunity for all these delusional ideas about being punished in hell to run wild for the weekend, if you will. So So by the time I was admitted to the hospital on, I guess it was a Sunday afternoon, I had already, I'd really constructed this crazy world as a way of adapting to the experience I was having.
And how are you today?
I feel pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, but I haven't had the experience that you've had. So are you, I mean, I don't want to use the word cured, but are you, do you have any of the, even a remnant of this that goes on at any time today in the last couple of years?
I would say no. No, I really don't. It was 30, 35 years ago, 1979. So that type of thing, I don't have a remnant of. I do, I think it left me with a feeling that we all need to, all of us need to maintain our mental health in one way or the other. I think people who are maybe people who say, well, I'm not at all crazy, perhaps a person might say that. I think either they're in denial and maybe they are a little crazy, or they just naturally and organically maintain good mental health because they have good connections with other people. They basically maintain their diet, sleep, exercise, all that good stuff that makes us healthy. But yeah, I do think that that's part of my message is everybody needs to keep an eye on mental health just as we keep an eye on physical health.
Mm-hmm. So you think we're all a little off?
Well, you know, now that you put it that way, we're all a little off. Yeah, I guess I think we all have the potential to be a little off. And, I think most people go through difficult periods in their lives and then they make some adjustment or learn some lesson and keep going, you know.
Uh-huh. So what have you learned about dealing with adversity and resilience? What lesson can you share with us that would be helpful?
Well, I think for me, the primary thing is to stay connected to people that are close to me. You know, I'm I have a small men's group that started out of this a local church here, and I'm also in 12-step programs for addiction recovery, and those give me really close relationships with other men, and I also have some good close female friends as well. One of my colleagues in my that I work with in my building is a really close friend of my wife's, went to school with my wife. So yeah, I would say I just have these very kind of close, open friendships where I don't need to have secrets. I don't need to have secret, crazy thoughts running around in my head. Any time I feel like I'm getting upset or things are a little stressful, for example, try writing a book and releasing it. That's pretty mm-hmm. very fun, but it's stressful. But I don't keep that stuff bottled up anymore. As I certainly did, you know, prior to that experience.
Mm-hmm. Where did your addiction come into play here, if at all?
Well, it's kind of hinted at. I talk once in a while about alcohol and that sort of thing. Sort of turning to what you might call idolatries or attachments or false gods would be another way to put it.
Okay. I'm not sure I understand what you mean by that part.
Well, I think that we turn to, let's take alcohol, for example. We turn to that alcoholic spirit, if you will, to fix feelings that we need to be dealing with in a more direct way.
Mm-hmm.
And since I have this sort of spiritual take on things, I look at it from a spiritual standpoint. So, for example, in Buddhism, they talk about attachments to false things that aren't going to really give you what you need. And in Christianity, they talk about idolatry or false gods. All of that is a way of talking about turning to something outside ourselves to fix our feelings, rather than going directly into the issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why? So, what triggered after 30 years? What was the impetus to write about this?
Well, my wife and I downsized. We moved into a condo, and that was in about 2007. And it just seemed like it was time. I think I've looked at other memoir writers. A lot of times people write a memoir in their 50s. And So I spent a certain, a good bulk of my my 50s. It took me 7 years total to write this book. I wasn't writing it full time, of course, but because I had to do my job. But it just seemed time. It was, I think in your 50s, you kind of get this now or never feeling about whether it's writing a book or sailing around the world. You know, I think a lot of people get that.
Huh, okay. All right, well, I'm 54, so maybe it's time for me to write the book while I'm sailing around the world. But, you know, the problem is I never saw a fluorescent god, so we're not going to be as interesting as yours.
So you may not have a story worth writing?
No, I don't think I have any stories that are very interesting or worth telling. You know, certainly no, I haven't met any interesting people in the past 24 years doing this show.
Well, I'm gonna assume that's a bit satiric comment there, and
every week I have somebody on who says that they've seen a fluorescent, you know, fill in the blank. It gets a little routine after a while.
Okay.
So what about your practice? Tell me about your practice and how you do your practice and how, based on what happened to you, that affected what you do.
So I didn't go directly from the experience in the mental hospital into becoming a psychotherapist. I spent 15 years in television and theater and writing comedy and performing comedy. So there wasn't that direct link, but once I got my training and started working in the field, I realized that I had a certain comfortability around people who are disturbed, and then I recognized, oh yeah, that comes because I was like this myself at one point and lived amongst people who are disturbed, and so that really helped my work a lot. Today in private practice, I don't work with people who are as disturbed as I was, but I still think that just the general idea that we can work through our problems, that life can be a meaningful story. Some of the things that I took away from that experience still inform the work I do, for sure.
Well, you know, it just seems as though there are so many people in this country suffering from depression. Do you have any sort of sense of what's wrong out there, why people feel so challenged on that?
Well, I think that can have to do with this idea of a meaningful story or a meaningful life. I think that sometimes depression comes out of an unexamined sense that life is worthless or life is meaningless or life is very, very negative. And now I'm not saying that's universally true for all depression, but that's the area that I would probably focus on given what my experience has been. So to take a look at that, go into the philosophy behind that, go into the theology behind that, if there is any, and then ask oneself, well, we do generally choose to live day to day, and what's the positive force behind that? Try to turn up the light on the positive impetus that people feel. I mean, a lot of people, very few people deny, for example, the existence of love. And so if one says, yeah, I think love is an important force, or love exists, or something like that, sort of nurture that, light that kindling, and see what's there in terms of a positive impetus for living.
Mm-hmm. That's a good place to end.
Yeah.
Thanks for your
time.
All
right, well, I hope you get that book written sometime.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe you'll make the index.
What?
Maybe you'll be in the index. You know,
okay.
maybe I'll include
you'll
in
just write up all the interesting people you've met over the years and write each of them up from your standpoint.
Yeah, just I could have you in the fluorescent section.
Okay, under F. All right.
Thanks for your time this morning. Good luck.
You bet. Thanks, Mark.
Joe Guppy is the author of My Fluorescent Guide, talking about his experience with mental illness and also now his work as a psychotherapist. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about, there's a housing conference going on up in Burlington today, and one of the speakers there is talking about what he sees as fewer young people purchasing homes, and we'll talk about why that's happening and also what the consequences are of that. We'll do that right after these important announcements.
Hi, this is Rich Harvey at Montpelier Pharmacy and Waterbury Pharmacy. When you shop at local businesses, you support those businesses, but what you may not realize is that you're supporting many other local businesses. We buy more than 90% of our supplies from Burlington Drug in Milton, Vermont. Because we keep the money in Vermont, more jobs are created here. When you buy from a national chain, most of the money goes out of state and stays there. And the next time you're at a fundraiser or a local event, it's usually local companies who are the main supporters of these events. Neighbors helping neighbors. So buy local. I'd like to personally say thank you to all of you who support us as we continue to grow. If you have questions about your prescriptions, give us a call at Montpelier Pharmacy, 223-4633, or Waterbury Pharmacy, 244-7701. Locally owned and very happy to be independent. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. It's Alan Buzz Busby from Poulin Auto Sales and Service. October was awesome for us. We had an all-time best month, and we've got to thank all of our customers for making that possible. I personally want not only to thank our customers for shopping Poulin Auto Sales and Service and getting the best deals that the others won't touch, but I've got to thank our team. You all went above and beyond and made it happen. Poulin has been going through some awesome changes, and without the support, the determination of our team, it just wouldn't happen. Next time you're shopping for a vehicle, shop Poulin Auto Sales and Service. We've got the inventory, an awesome 3-year, 100,000-mile warranty, and you just can't forget about the 0% financing on the previously owned vehicles. So if you haven't shopped Poulin Auto lately, you just haven't shopped Poulin, because we're changing the way you feel about buying a car. Visit us on East Berry Road in Berry or Shelburne Road in South Burlington. We're always open at PoulinAutoSales.com.
RB Technologies on Route 14 East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Peter Timponi from the Vermont College of Fine Arts.
Ruben and all of his crew have been working with us over the last 2.5 years. We recently had some electrical damage in the building, which took down the entire network, and they were in helping us the next day. It was a real, real pleasure working with them. It helped us out a ton. Here at Vermont College, we're a small operation. Our IT department, we have two people, so it's often hard sometimes to find the right bit of knowledge that we might need. So I have actually called Ruben before and spoke with them about, you know, things that I'm trying to do, things that I'm trying to accomplish, and they have been very helpful in guiding us along the way. Friendly, courteous, knowledgeable are the first three words that come to my head when I think about Ruben and everyone there, and they're a great, great crew.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Call them at 223-4448 or online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
I'm Ted Shattuck. As a doctor practicing in Rutland for over 30 years, I have witnessed firsthand insurance companies interfering in the medical decisions of doctors and their patients. That's one of the reasons why I support Vermont's plan to switch to Green Mountain Care, a publicly funded, universal health care system. Everybody is in, nobody's out, and Vermonters can get the care they need when they need it.
Paid for by Vermont Leads, Montpelier, Vermont.
Breaking news on Radio Vermont is brought to you in part by National Life Group in Montpelier. For over 165 years, at National Life Group, they believe good matters. It's their yardstick. Judge not by how well they do for themselves, but how much good they do for their customers and each other. Not just because it feels good, but because they believe that good is good business. Do good. Be good. Make good. National Life Group.
.44-1777, our local number, toll free. You can reach us at 877-291-8255. That's 291-TALK. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk with a local orthodontist and a young woman that he helped as part of a community project. That'll be coming your way at about 10:15 after our White House report this morning. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Anthony Poor, who's with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. And Anthony's going to be part of a conference that's going up in Burlington, statewide housing conference. And he's going to be talking on the topic of home ownership's lost generation. Anthony, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, Mark, and thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Tell me a little bit more about your work at the Federal Reserve. I know you've been there for quite some time doing what?
Well, my job is the manager of our community development efforts. Within our regional and community outreach department, we focus solely on the needs of low and moderate income communities throughout New England. And we do that through three different ways. Primarily, one is the development of high quality unbiased research, some of which we'll bring to bear today. Two is the ability to really convene stakeholders across a wide variation of sectors, really to focus on issues where there might not be conversations taking place before. And then third, obviously, is because of the scale and the breadth of the system, both as individual banks, 12, and our Board of Governors, the ability to really disseminate this information out. So those are the three main roles that we play, but our sole focus, at least within the regional community outreach unit within the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, is on low and moderate income communities.
You know, I had no idea that the Federal Reserve Bank was even involved at this level of discussion.
You know, it's funny, Mark. Most people don't realize that. But, you know, I'm one of about 120 professionals throughout the United States and all 12 regional banks whose sole focus is on these communities. And, you know, it just depends on, you know, the bank. It reflects the regional needs, as you will. And so, for example, we organize our work around specific focal areas. Mm-hmm. Those might be, for example, around smaller industrial cities, access, community development lending and investing, household financial stability, financial capabilities, and, of course, home ownership and foreclosures. Those are our five focal areas, and that's where we put all of our energy, and all of our activities really go to support those primary areas.
That's interesting because, you know, I knew individual banks would do this sort of work, but I didn't think it reached up to the level of the Federal Reserve. So why does the Federal Reserve do this, and how does it affect the policies that you have?
Well, why we do this is because at the end of the day, we view ourselves as being public servants. And so we have an obligation and responsibility to serve the entire New England region, not just, you know, Main Street, not just Wall Street, but everything in between. So that's why we do that. Your other question was more related to how, or just remind me again, forgive me.
Well, how does doing this research, how does doing the focus, trying to disseminate this information, how does it then affect policy in terms of, you know, how you establish monetary policy?
Well, what we do within the Regional Community Outreach Unit, well, does it affect monetary policy directly? Probably not. It definitely has an indirect impact on that. But let me give you an example of something that's very tangible. For example, one of the reports my colleague Kylie Mauricio and I just drafted, it's called the New England Community Outlook Survey. We poll, for example, all the service organizations across New England. In our previous sample, we had 175 different organizations across eight different subsectors within the community development field. One of the interesting things that came up was this impact of suburban poverty. So we've been tracking this since 2010 and the increase. We've also focused here locally on issues of rural poverty. So my job is to really shed light and bring attention to issues that might not otherwise have a light shown on them, if you will, and to be able to begin and create spaces for conversations that we can talk about how this community or these communities can fit into larger efforts of a state, municipal government, et cetera.
Hmm. All right. What'd you find out about rural poverty that might be helpful for us to know?
Well, one, I live in New Hampshire, so this is not an issue that escapes me by any stretch of the imagination. And when you think about New England, if you think about what I call the north-south divide, you know, when you look at Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire, for example, we have more in common than we do separate.
Right.
We've looked at shifts in our historical industries away from what I call the three Fs, the farming, the fishing, and the forestry. And ultimately, we've seen shifts in now manufacturing to advanced manufacturing, and really the decline of our paper and pulp industry. So those are some of the things we see.
Yeah.
We're looking at declining populations. Vermont and Maine, for example, go back and forth in terms of the oldest state in the union. There are a number of issues that are specific to us as a region. But again, I think we also have opportunities because of our lack of scale and our ability to move the dial that sometimes require even less resource.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's talk about this issue of young people in buying homes. So how bad is it, Anthony?
Well, it's not I don't want to give the your listeners the idea that it's horrible, because it's not. What we're seeing is different segments of this population known as millennials are either A, purchasing homes more than they have before, but we're also seeing a decline, a much greater decline in the traditional first-time home buyers. And that would be, for example, a young couple, two incomes, et cetera, out purchasing home. We've seen particularly declines there. What my colleague and I, John Pelletier of Champaign College, will be talking about today, and what we thought we might highlight for the purposes of your audience, was we had focused in on four issues that we thought were particularly important to this group. One was kind of the broader economic situation. What's going on in the environment? How is that impacting millennials today and their new financial realities? We also wanted to look at the impact of student debt and their ability to purchase a home, the housing cost burden, which is a big issue here, particularly in the Burlington area where I happen to be about, looking at the available stock, and then, of course, the age demographic. So those are some of the things that we wanted to kind of look at. Now, we took data from a myriad of different sources. Some of that was from Vermont Housing Finance Authority, if you will, and others was from the census data and so on. We began to kind of create this discussion. We're with a group of people today, Mark, who know as much about this issue as I do. There's over 400 people here who are looking at this particular issue. It's our job just to be able to create a conversation and see where we can take it from here. And is there any ability for us to kind of support and other folks can learn from the data that we've been able to kind of put together?
I didn't quite understand the first point you made there. I got the student debt and the housing cost. I want to talk more about the age demographics. But what was the first point you made?
Well, for example, we've seen in terms of the environment, we've seen, for example, with the since the recession, employment has fell the most of any recession since, for example, World War II, right? That's an external circumstance. The same is true for real GDP growth, right? We've also seen income growth slow significantly over the past 10 years. So these are some of the environmental factors that are having a real impact on our millennials. What we looked at is particularly also was a declining income among younger households in relationship to some of the older households. So those are some of the broader economic impacts that we're seeing that are having a definitive impact on this group of folks.
We're talking with Anthony Poirier with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. He's participating in a statewide housing conference today in Burlington, talking about the issue of young people and purchasing homes. Are there any of those four that really outweigh the other three?
Well, I think one of the real issues here is the impact of wage. And I think one of the things that we'll be talking about today was really the impact of housing burden, the issues of wages and housing burden. And so, for example, one of the things that I looked at is I looked at some of, for example, the wage growth, recent release from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. What you saw was real wages increased by about 2.1%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I did is I looked at our two states, Vermont and New Hampshire. I looked at Vermont first. And what I saw, for example, at least in broader Vermont, you saw rents increase, median gross rents on a two-bedroom unit by 1.8%. Keeping, you know, the rents, for example, wages are keeping pace with rents, if you will. But if you, I want to look at where I'm at right now, recognizing that about a third of your population lives in the Burlington, South Burton, and Burlington, Chittenden County area. Those rents increased by 3.9%. So when you look at rents versus wages, you see that year over year, you know, wages aren't keeping pace, for example, with rents here in the Burlington area. The same could be said in my state, where we saw rents increase, average rents increase on a two-bedroom unit by 3.3%. So issues around wages and the increase in rents, you know, are really creating an issue for housing burden. I also have to say, when we looked at where folks live, you know, the majority of people, both renters and non-renters in Vermont, reside in homes that are built before 1960. I don't need to remind you or your listeners about the high cost of energy here in New England.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are they burdened by rents, but they're burdened by high energy prices that are just made even worse because they're living in homes who, for example, are outdated heating systems, they're built prior to ADA examples, they may have poor insulation, poor weatherization, et cetera. So I think that's one of the real issues that we're seeing. The other one related to that is, of course, this issue around student debt. I think everybody's aware of that.
Right, right. So how big an influence is student debt on hurting people's ability to buy a house or rent, or even rent?
It is having a tremendous impact on people's ability to purchase a home and for rent. You know, when you think about me as a family, my largest expense is my mortgage. The person's largest expense usually is their rent. That cannot be said necessarily for this generation. What we're seeing is that the student debt in terms of your debt-to-income ratio which is what is really kind of goes into purchasing a home. Well, one of the factors that goes into purchasing a home, rather, is having a particular impact, and real impact. I think it's very interesting. Even today, I believe, at 9 o'clock, today's Thursday, 9 o'clock, they're doing a piece that's looking at this, and we're also doing a piece, I think even today at 4 p.m. on VPR, there's a piece about that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What about the cost of housing? How far out of reach is it?
Is it far out of reach? I wouldn't say it's far out of reach because that tends to be a bit negative in terms of its connotation. Is the bar higher? Absolutely. Because what we're looking at is issues around declining wages, increases in rents, tighter lending requirements from banks. So it's a myriad of things. I will say that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that there's real opportunities for hope here, and I think that's really important.
Why do you say that?
Say that one more time?
Why do you say that there's hope out there? I mean, it seems like...
Because when you look at the situation and you look at the real data, that what you're seeing is that at least... one of the other factors having an impact is this issue around baby boomers. You know, baby boomers aren't moving, can't really afford to move. They've seen a tremendous loss of wealth. But also at the same time is that conditions are getting better, generally speaking, and there is light at the end of the tunnel. So what I talk about is really those boomers will be downsizing. They're going to make available those smaller homes, which are typical of the first homes that are purchased by younger families. Millennials, those with capital, have it somewhat been sitting on the sideline waiting for the economy to recover. Supply is tightening, so that means housing prices are going up, allowing people to generate equity and wealth. We're seeing increasingly favorable lending conditions. The lending conditions are beginning to relax. And we've seen a number of months of sustained job creation and improving wages. So, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. It is not all lost. And so this is, you know, and we want to highlight that too, right? Because perception does frame, to a certain extent, a portion of reality.
Let's go to Waitsfield. Michael, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question I want to ask. I think one of the biggest problems in young people buying homes today is future return on investment. When you buy a house and you bring up your family there and you live there 30 years, and then you want to go and resell the house and move to a retirement community or something like that. For instance, in my wife's family, she lived in a house that cost her father $39,000. And there was a small house in a very small community, happened to be in Queens, New York. And that house actually sold for $640,000. Now, I don't understand that the person that moved in, who is in New York, makes a pretty good middle-class income. But still, what is he going to sell that house for? He's going to raise his two kids there. He's going to stay there 30 years. He's never going to get $2 million for this tiny little house. No. Most Vermonters won't even buy it.
You never know that.
I think there's a big problem on return on investment in real estate homes today.
All right. Anthony, what do you think of that?
You know, I'm not familiar with the New York, you know, housing experience, but I think what this caller may be referencing is just the in particular markets, you know, New York, Boston, et cetera. I mean, reality is that home prices are increasing at really a steep pace. And, you know, traditional middle-income people are finding it increasingly more difficult to afford them. So I think he raises a real issue. You know, is it something that I think that needs to be looked at? Sure. But I really couldn't even begin to think about what's going on there in New York. My focus is really on New England, and particularly our rural environment.
Well, he was actually talking about a house in Vermont.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he said New York. Please
no, somebody from New York purchased it who was wealthy. That was what he was saying.
Oh, it was a second home.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Well, I think I'm not familiar with the data here in Vermont around second homes. So, again, I apologize for that. But I think what he's talking about is when he talked about his return on investment. I mean, you know, I was just interfacing with some of the folks here, and for example, they share with me that the average home prices here are increasing at a traditional pace about 1.3% per annum. That's not ordinary, frankly. And that's what you would tend to expect. So what he cited is something. I mean, we go, would you say 39,000 up to over 600,000?
Right. Yeah.
There's something going on there that I couldn't even begin to speak to.
All right, but let me ask you this. You say that the gap here is it's increasingly difficult for people to purchase a first home. So it seems as though 30 years ago or 25 years ago that your wages, if you had a two-family wage income, two-income family, that the wages were enough to finance a home. Is that still true today, given that stagnation in income?
That is still true today. Albeit there are other pressures that those folks had have today that people at 25 years ago did not have. And one of the most pressing issues here is the issue of debt, and particularly student debt, and putting those ratios to a certain extent out of whack. And I think that's a real issue here as it relates to millennials. I think, again, when you think about this, too, I think part of this, and this is kind of outside the scope of this presentation, but I think in New England, one of the things that folks are beginning to look at is as we have shifted away from our traditional industries that I referenced before, the farming, the fishing, the forestry, and really paper and pulp, those are positions and jobs that pay a living wage, right? Mm-hmm. And you can do exactly as you've described. We've seen shifts in our economy away from manufacturing, now more towards service sector economies. Typically pay a bit of a lower wage, make things increasingly more difficult. I think the question in front of Vermont, New Hampshire, et cetera, where you're seeing our population getting older, you're seeing people leave our communities, what can we do to keep these young people here, and what can we do to ensure that there are good living wage jobs available so they can raise and do exactly what this gentleman said, is raise a family up, do right by them, and then see them go on and prosper and go beyond where they would even hope to have been at that age.
All right. Well, what can Vermont do to keep young people from leaving?
Oh, my gosh. That's a $10,000 question right there. I think there are three states right now are grappling with this issue and have been for a long time. And there's a laundry list of things you could think about. I mean, and I hear this all the time. People talk about education. They talk about schools. They talk about access to services. They talk about access to living wage positions. They talk about access to affordable education. Again, there's a myriad of things that states can do. The question is, what are they doing to coordinate these efforts, and how can they take advantage of both internal and external circumstance? I think, and it's still out, right? Mm-hmm. They're still grappling with these issues, mm-hmm. and New Hampshire is right with you.
Last question. So are there any public policy changes that you think have to happen?
I think you've asked a very interesting point, and I think this is a question we'll be talking about here in Vermont within this context, which is at some level, at the policy level, you've got some competing interests, right? One of the most pressing issues here in Vermont is the preservation of the current affordable housing stock. Many of the affordable housing stock was purchased through tax credits. Those tax credits are beginning to expire, and they can lose their affordability quotient. Related to that is really access to capital, which is being able to access new capital to build additional affordable housing units. Again, it's a real issue. So I think from a policy perspective here in Vermont, you've got some competing interests. I think they're real. We have to come to some sort of compromise, and here in the state, you all do rather, to try to figure out which is priority, and then how to move forward, you know, with a kind of a forward-thinking agenda.
So we could stay way ahead of New Hampshire, too.
You could.
Yeah, I think you should probably, you know, switch sides here and join the other, join the Vermont team.
Well, listen, we got more in common than we do different. One of us just happens to be upside down. You can figure out which one of us it is.
That's right. There you go. Thanks for your time, Anthony. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Mark. And if it's going to be helpful, you let me know.
All right. Anthony Pores with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. Huh, if I could be helpful, maybe, you know, maybe he's got an extra 20 or 50 lying around. Who knew? Who even knew that the Federal Reserve did this sort of work? That's interesting. All right. Moment of your time for our friends at Greenmount Nexus. Give them a jingle today for outstanding internet service. Toll free 1-888-321-0815 is their phone number. And on the web, gmavt.net. We'll be back right after this.
Are you age 65 or retiring soon? Vermonters retiring soon or just becoming eligible for Medicare can find out more about Medicare and Medicare products from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont. Here's how. Attend an informational session to learn more about health after retirement, including information on Vermont Medigap Blue, affordable Medicare supplemental coverage offered through Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont's affiliate, the Vermont Health Plan. Statewide sessions are running through early December. For more information, call Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont's Medicare specialist, Jill, at 802-371-3299, email medigap@bcbsvt.com, or visit bcbsvt.com/VMB. You can also meet one-on-one with Jill on Tuesdays and Thursdays at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont's Information and Wellness Center at the South Burlington Blue Mall, or by appointment on Mondays and Wednesdays at their headquarters. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
When it snows, certain people get very excited. Skiers, snowboarders, kids in school, and everyone at Formula Ford Truckland. The place to go if you want to dominate the snow. Formula Ford, right at the roundabout in Montpelier, is Truckland, with every size, style, make, and model of Ford truck available. And since we've got so many, Formula Ford's prices bury the competition like an avalanche. Plus, we're your Fisher Plow and Sander connection, so we can outfit your truck any way you like. And if you think we've got this truck thing down, you gotta see how we do with cars, crossovers, SUVs, and vans. Everyone backed up by the best parts, service, and collision center people around. Formula Ford is the total package, right at the roundabout, 265 River Street in Montpelier. When it starts coming down, you come down. Because at Formula Ford, there's no business like snow business. See dealer for details.
Thinking about doing some projects on your home? A home improvement loan from Granite Hills Credit Union is the answer. It's quick and easy. Borrow up to $10,000 with this personal loan at a great fixed low rate. No appraisal or title search required. Remodel your kitchen, replace your roof, or add a room. You decide. Looking to do a larger project? We have home equity loans with new lower rates or a line of credit that allows the flexibility of check writing. Give us a call, stop in, or visit us at granitehills.org to find out how you can make your remodeling dreams come true.
Granite Hills Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by the NCUA.
Season, you can collect and win cash and other great prizes with the new Holiday Collect and Win from the Vermont Lottery. Use your smartphone to download the free Collect and Win app or go online. From now till December 13th, when you play qualifying draw games like Powerball, Megabucks, and others, you can scan the ticket or enter online to collect game symbols. Collect 6 game symbols on one card and you're entered for a chance to win over $50,000 in prizes. Go to vtlottery.com for more Collect and Win details. Please play responsibly.
Hi folks, this is Jerry Booth. Vermonters drink Booth Brothers milk every day. They know they can trust Booth Brothers for great tasting milk with no artificial growth hormones. It's local, it's fresh, it's healthy. And it's produced right here in central Vermont. In a world that's constantly changing, it's good to know where your milk comes from. 27 local farms with the same goal, only the freshest, the finest Booth Brothers milk. So the next time you're in a dairy aisle, reach for Booth Brothers.
Coming up next hour, we're going to meet a local orthodontist and one of his patients that he helped, part of a project to give back to the community. Coming up on the program tomorrow, we'll kick off the program tomorrow. We'll talk with author Mark Leibovich, who has written a book called Citizens of the Green Room. Mark is the national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, and he's written this story about the lives, stories, and peculiarities behind some of the great public figures out there. He writes a lot of profiles of people in politics and some of those terrible, gosh-awful people in the media, too. So we'll chat with him coming up to kick off the program tomorrow. We'll take a break for news. We'll be back in just a few moments. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugarbush and the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is next.
I'm Tim McGuire. Bob Velazquez has lived in Hamburg, New York, a suburb south of Buffalo, long enough